And I think that's probably something around athletes. We probably, one, we don't educate athletes well on what they're really good at within sport that comes naturally, because there's no certificate, so to speak.
Yep.
You know, they tend to be quite good leaders just naturally because they're in and around good leaders. Andre Agassi talks about in his book Open that he's like, his number one perceived fear was that he's perceived as a dumb athlete. And I think we need to flip that a bit in terms of sort of giving them confidence that, hey, you know what, we're actually looking for the attributes that you have as a human. We can worry about the certificates and the education and that sort of stuff later, but let's get this right, because that's what's going to hold you in good stead once you finish your career. It's about all the high performers, like even you listen to high performance podcasts and high performance sport and people talk about it, and nearly every single one of them said that sport is about 90% mental and 10% physical, and yet we train 90% in the physical and about 10% on the mindset. So until we sort of get that balance right, I think, I would argue that sometimes actually just getting the balance right is more important than actually that extra bit of physical training.
Mastering balance is never easy, especially when you're juggling sport, work, family, and life. Today's guest, William Tuffley, shares how high-performing men can create harmony both on and off the field. With a lifelong passion for sport and a deep understanding of the challenges athletes face, Will helps players protect their financial future, maximize earning capacity, and navigate life during and after their careers. In this episode, we explore how to prioritize physical and mental health, keep sport fun, and lead with purpose. Will also shares incredible success stories, memorable fan moments, and practical insights that every sports-loving man can apply to his own life. Whether you're striving for peak performance, managing a busy life, or just love the game, this conversation is packed with actionable lessons and entertaining stories to help you master your own art of balance. I'm Ian Hawkins, and this is Sport is Life. The purpose of sport, as I see it, is to see your vision become a reality. Find your voice, create strong connections, and learn to trust your body. Hey Will, how you going?
Good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Welcome. Now let's get the hard stuff out of the way first. We were just talking about the final series, and you were giving me a bit of grief about the Eels flag in the background, and you're actually in mourning at the moment because your mighty Raiders are so close yet so far.
Yeah, I think if you'd asked at the start of the season, we would have probably taken it, but I think when you get that close, you sort of, it hurts a bit. But I think what is positive is I think what Ricky's doing down there, the Raiders, is a bit, I think he's sort of trying to create that type of dynasty. And I think even just from a community aspect, everyone's still behind the team. I don't think it's always about wins down there, which I think is a really good attitude. And I think it's funny, if you have a look at the cultures of some of the teams that have done well, it is a bit about dynasty, like the Panthers and the Storm and those sort of teams, where it's trying to build a good organisation, just as much as it is, the wins are almost like an organic flow and effect, I suppose.
Absolutely, and certainly building a great, the whole system. Like, they've tried the buying from New Zealand, they've tried buying from the UK, and now they're just trying to get the best young kids, and how would that work this year? Good mix of the old experienced heads and youngsters, mate. What a ride.
Absolutely. But yeah, let's not talk about that anymore.
Right, we're done. Therapy session over.
Thank you.
Now, we connected a little while ago. You were working in a whole lot of things around athlete welfare, but probably the most important one is around their financial side. Tell us a little bit about what you do, Will.
Yeah, so I'm an accountant by trade, so tax compliance, accounting, so boring stuff. I won't go into too much detail there. But I suppose the passion project, I sort of call it, and the thing that I'm really keen to sort of drive some behavioural change in is that athlete move from sport to business. And then obviously the financial things that come around that. So I don't like calling it a transition phase. I like calling it a repurposing phase. And it's all about what we can do when we're in sport to maximize what we do next. And whether that is, you know, the way we work with money, the way we do BD, the way we do networking, all those things within sport to sort of really help with that. So that we've done that through a couple of services. We do sort of like an athlete health check rather than sort of engaging them straight away, depending on the type of level of athlete they are. We do a bit of a health check type thing just to seeing where they're at, and that might be just being giving them some strong acumen to be able to push back on their current accountants or their current advisors, and just give them a little bit of education around that, especially but being very specific around the sports world and what's coming at them. And then we've also written an athlete development program, which is very much like a 5-module program around helping with that repurposing phase. So that's sort of what we're doing here amongst, as you said, amongst doing normal compliance and accounting and tax work, but that makes it a bit more interesting. The stuff we have to do.
What about, okay, let's just sort of do two ends of the spectrum. How would you, if you're looking at the bloke who's at the top of the moment, and particularly around earning capacity, Reece Walsh, if you got a hold of him, what steps would you take him through?
Yeah, I mean, he's probably a bit of a unique one because he's still very young, so he's still early stage, but high earning capacity as well. So I think there's a few things. I think no matter how good Reece is going to be, and maybe he's going to be more that sort of immortal level, so maybe he will get, you know, those speaking gigs and the you know, he might probably end up on Channel 9 like all the other, the immortal type players. But I think for me, it's trying to work, give him an opportunity to find out right now, okay, what are you passionate about? Like, do you know what you want to do next? We don't make plumbing. That a scary
plumbing, yeah, apparently.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what? If that's where he honestly wants to go, like, I think that's great. How do we maximize any business ventures he wants to do on the part of that? He might be really happy being a plumber post-career. Awesome. Let's get that to be a point where he wants it to be. And what can we do now? So start thinking about that process. Is it a little bit of micro-credentialing? Is it a bit of business coursework? Because even if he is a plumber, he's still going to have to understand what a P&L and a balance sheet is. Yeah. He's still going to have to understand cash flow. So there is that little bit of micro-credentialing we can do on the way. What's the most that we can do now? So I think that's probably something around athletes. We don't educate athletes well on what they're really good at within sport that comes naturally, because there's no certificate, so to speak. Yep. You know, they tend to be quite good leaders just naturally because they're in and around good leaders and leadership of different levels, whether that's being the quiet leader who leads by example on the field versus the, you know, the great talkers and leaders in that sort of retrospect. They're very diligent. They work hard. They're sort of high performance risk. They're willing to take that a little bit. They take on constructive feedback. I think one thing that they do really well is they're probably willing to learn. So I think we don't give them, say, like, that's actually an attribute that's really worthwhile in business. So that's trying to get them to understand how important that is. And then work on the other stuff and the education stuff on a bit. Because I know Andre Agassi talks about in his book Open that he's like, his number one perceived fear was that he's perceived as a dumb athlete. And I think we need to flip that a bit in terms of sort of giving them confidence that, hey, you know what, we're actually looking for the attributes that you have as a human. We can worry about the certificates and the education and that sort of stuff later, but let's get this right, because that's what's going to hold you in good stead once you finish your career.
Actually, I'm pretty sure we spoke about this when we chatted about a month ago, because the thing that stuck with me from that book was him sitting like at the crossroads of his career, the sort of in that middle between his early career and then the later career when he came back with the, you know, the shaved head and won a whole lot more Grand Slams, was him sitting there watching the paper boy and just realizing, well, what a gift for me to be able to go out and play tennis to make money and not having to do something like delivering a paper or something. But also him realizing, but there's a whole lot of young people like that I could help, and him sort of finding that purpose. And I know that's something you're big on, right? Is like, it's rather than being transition, it's like, let's tap into that part of you that you're naturally good at and that purpose, so that it's not just in your career, it's like your whole life.
That's right. I mean, like even if you have an absolute amazing rugby league career, let's say it goes for 15 years, potentially your working life is 50 years. So it's still only, you know, 30% of your entire working career, even the best one. I think there's some stats around that the average NRL career, as an example, is about 2.5 years in length. So, you know, put that into respective of 60 years or something, it's a pretty minute amount of time. So
yeah, and the average earnings not that high either when you look at it from that perspective, where it's only a 2.5, maybe it's only 2.5 years, and all those ones even less. Not all of them are earning really good money, are they?
No, they're not. And but what they do have is access to some really good networks, some really good quick, fast learning skill sets, because they're in this team environment that potentially their peers or people that they then compete with in the workforce at the other end of their career don't get just come naturally to them. And it's a lot easier to teach people how to do things on paper than it is those behavioral attributes. So I think that's where we need to sort of get better at educating athletes on that.
Yeah, and is that part of the modules that you do, is educating them on some of those behavioural aspects?
Yeah, definitely. So the modules that we talk about is sort of that mindset balance type stuff. So who's on your bus, focus on the process rather than the result. Looking at things like leadership and those sort of things within business, and having some hard conversations around, righto, this is where I want to get to post-sport, so what do I need to do now? You know, even just the way they live their lifestyle and not making sure they're not having that lifestyle creep, depending on their income, having those sort of conversations and setting that up. We talk about accounting. We talk about some investment. The investment thing's mainly around just avoiding that locker room chat and not getting, caught up in potential conflicts with people who are also investing in that sort of stuff, and just getting some little bit of understanding, because we see that a lot. And then business entrepreneurship is one. That's mainly around, again, those business skills. So even if you are just wanting to do a plumbing business after, you still need to understand P&L, balance sheet, cash flow, where it's important, why it's important. But also athletes tend to sit on boards, even if it's just on a players association board. Part of their role as a director of those boards is to actually understand, righto, what's our P&L look like, balance sheet look like, are we running solvent, those sort of things. So it's really important for them to understand that. We also talk about a little bit around capital raising there as well, because a lot of probably the wealthier athletes tend to get looped into the startup world, and it's just giving them some education on how that world looks like, and not everything's a success story in that.
Not flushing money down the toilet, but actually giving them some background so they make right decisions.
A lot of people, most people who make some half decent money have made bad decisions, so there's still a learning process there, but it's probably just getting rid of those really easy ones that you can mitigate. And then business, professional development and networking. So again, looking at things like, what's your LinkedIn profile look like? What's your resume look like? How can we start doing some research, some education, micro-credentialing now to sort of set you up? I think, and I think the other thing with that, it's not a cookie cutter process. So everyone is going to be different. Everyone that you're going to talk to is going to have a different process in terms of how they go it. I think sometimes in sport we try and do a cookie cutter process around trying to fit everyone into this box. But even if it's the exact same player with the exact same interest on exactly the same money with the same ambitions, because of their family, that might then be a totally different conversation or where they need to go, purely based on, are they going into a family business versus this person's going to be going out on their own once they finish their career. So it's trying to get away from that sort of tick of the box cookie cutter approach.
Yeah, love it. Let's go to the other side of the other end of the spectrum. Well, it's still elite sport, but like someone like who's an Olympic athlete, like track and field or swimming, I guess it's probably the lower level of swimming, but those like maybe canoeing, kayaking, where they've got to be still full-time athletes. At the same time, they've got to earn some money on the side. And like, what would the be the guidance there to help them maximise their earning potential?
Yeah, oh, look, I think it's a really hard area with that Olympic sport. And sometimes I get a little bit worried if both the business community and the federal, federal level of government doesn't come to the party a little bit, we're going to lose some Olympic athletes potentially to some of the bigger sports. And I think we do need to start collaborating as a nation within all sports so that all sports sort of thrive in Australia. So that actually does worry me a bit. So, but from an individual perspective, I think it's, again, just being able to utilise potentially the networks. I think one thing about Olympic sports is most likely it's a global sport. So you straight away have a global network that potentially, say, an NRL or an AFL might not have that global reach. So straight away there's potentially a benefit. There's huge businesses involved in Olympic sport, right? Like, it's a global games. It's people, you know, there's big business involved in it that itself is a big business. You know, with 32 coming, you can already see the appetite from businesses wanting to potentially start basing themselves, whether it's in Brisbane or Queensland or in Australia, off the back of that. So there is some opportunity there. I'm definitely not saying it's going to be an easy road, but I think there's definitely some little things we can start looking at. One thing I definitely think that we need to look at is, sometimes I think we get athletes to potentially do part-time education or education to keep them as a bit of a, hey, you need some balance. But I think we need to look at that on an individual basis and go, well, is just doing a part-time degree right now the most appropriate way for you to get ahead or for you to keep the balance? Because potentially it may be actually, I don't really know what I want to do yet. Maybe going and doing some part-time work or going and having a look at industry, following some CEOs around or people within workplaces, trying to get behind them and do that first and then working out what you want to do. And then when you actually have the time to do it full time, potentially that's when you smash it out. Now, that's not going to be for everyone. There might be some people that were like, look, I wanted to do law. I always knew I wanted to do law. Okay, well, let's try and get as much of that knocked over as possible. But I get that. But I think sometimes we try and think that education is the balance rather than that's get the industry experience, get that stuff up because while you have a great network and then smash the degree out in the end.
Yeah, I actually love that approach. How many people at that age know what they want to do?
Use it as an advantage, almost like, oh, I have a little bit more time to actually work out what I want to do. But, you know, because I do see a lot of like part-time business degrees come across my desk where they've still got the HEX debt. And that's the other understanding is sometimes because they don't see the HEX debt because they're not actually earning enough money to actually pay it off. So again, they don't actually see the bill there at that point in time, but it can then affect how much they earn when they start earning money. And then obviously their borrowing capacity when they want to buy a house as well. So I think educating to tick a box, we've got to be really careful with.
Yeah, I love it. So we've kind of jumped in the deep end at like what you're doing and some of the thoughts on current situation, but where you've had a lifetime of sport, like what was your sport of choice growing up? Like were you just like a sport tragic? You just did everything and you just loved it, you watched it, you played it?
Yeah, I was one of three boys and from the country, so yeah, it was pretty much play in the backyard until dark and then swap the cricket ball over for a glow-in-the-dark cricket ball when we could find them from a Neymar All Sports or something like that. And then we'd go in the living rooms and do putting competitions and, you know, anything we do. So we definitely were very sport heavy in our family. And I was lucky to have two brothers who were really passionate about it as well. So it's always sort of been ingrained in me. I was lucky enough to play half-decent level in Brisbane. I played first grade rugby and a little bit of first grade cricket as well. And I also played some semi-professional rugby in Hong Kong played some club cricket in England and as well in the UK. And I was in Oxford for about 6.5 months, which was awesome as well. So been really lucky in terms of and probably those two sports as well. Really lucky because they're global sports. So it took me around the world. I've got friends all over the globe. I've been to weddings all around the world because of that as well, which has been really fortunate. And also probably even at, say, a first grade level here in Brisbane, had a lot of Wallabies and Australian and Queensland cricketers come back and play at that level as well. So I've sort of been, you know, in and around those sort of really elite athletes as well. So that's probably given me enough knowledge around what we can do better and how we can do things better. It probably just reiterated to me that I was never going to be that good enough to play at the professional level. There were some moments, you know, playing first grade in rugby especially, where, you know, a guy would come back from playing, you know, Queensland, and I'd be just like, well, if he can barely make the Queensland team, then I'm no chance. So, I was probably, sometimes I say I was lucky in that respect, because I needed to know that I had to do something else.
Yeah, but I think also a bit like coaches, who, like, the most gifted player is rarely a good coach, because they don't understand the battle, and they don't understand the different challenges, and then they don't understand the solutions to be able to overcome them. I imagine from the perspective that you're talking, is that you would have seen things that those high level athletes wouldn't have seen, because they'd be too clouded by, you know, the drive to get where they're going, or the dollar signs, or whatever it is. And do you think that's your experience? Is like you actually seeing that is a from a more balanced perspective?
Yeah, definitely. And I think there's a lot of there's a lot of different things pulling at that as well. I think, without getting too critical, I think sport does tend to love control a little bit. So therefore, the athlete probably doesn't have the flexibility that they may think, or, you know, that they're not allowed to. I definitely think in general, we focus too much on creating athletes rather than creating the human. People. And so they're people. And so we're better off doing an extra gym session than we are actually just getting your head right. And you talked about all the high performers, like, even you listen to high performance podcasts and high performance sport, and people talk about it, and nearly every single one of them said that sport is about 90% mental and 10% physical, and yet we train 90% in the physical and about 10% on the mindset. So until we sort of get that balance right, I would argue that sometimes actually just getting the balance right is more important than actually that extra bit of physical training, you know, and especially with Australian sports. I think American sports tend to be very that, you know, being the fastest, being the most clinical, being the biggest, being the strongest. Those sports tend to suit that, whereas I think the Australian sports, sometimes there tends to be that little bit more instinct type play within it, especially, you know, your rugby leagues, your rugby unions. There is a bit more that instinct type play, AFL, cricket, all those. So I think a bit more focus on the human rather than the athlete, I think, would go a long way.
Yeah, 100%. And I'm sure you've found this with your courses, but, like, more often than not with an athlete, we're doing some sports-specific mindset stuff, but we're also doing probably more than half is just around them, the people aspect, and where they get in their own heads, or something that's going on in their personal life. Like, to me, it's no coincidence that the Broncos won, because I know that Madge puts a lot of time and energy into the leadership, into the mental side, the emotional side. I know at least one of the guys he's got in his stable who was with him in Origin as well, and they're guys that, like, really build that stuff. So yes, everyone's talking about the physical stuff, but to me, I'd be thinking it's the mental stuff that he would have done that would have come through in that really high intense physical stuff that would have been having a bigger impact than what anyone's given him credit. It's funny what you say. They all say that, don't they? The 90%.
Yeah. And even, like, I think it's interesting when people say, oh, such and such is going really well in the back end of their career because they've just got more experience now. And I would argue, I was like, no, it's just because they're way more balanced. Like, you know, like, I think, like, Usman Khawaja to me is, like, a really good example, right? Like, I think it's no coincidence when he sort of had his revamp of career. If you have a look at what he was doing outside sport, it was, you know, he's got a family, he's been married, he's got kids, but he's doing some business stuff around. And so when he was going out on the field, it wasn't about, oh, crap, am I going to get a duck or not? It's like, oh, how good, I get to play cricket again. Doesn't worry me if I get out or not. And you could just see that in the way he played. You know, I reckon Cochin's probably a good example, where he's, like, killed it in the back end of his career. Yeah. And I just reckon he had really good balance. It wasn't to do with the fact that he was experienced, because you'd argue that the body's not as good. You're not as fast. You're not as quick. But, and so you aren't as athletic as you are as a 21-year-old, but you've just got balance. So yes, there's some experience stuff there. You can cut corners and understand your body a bit more. There's definitely that aspect, but
yeah.
I just think it's to comes down to a bit more around balance.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I mean, you know, you've got kids. Like the moment you have children, your perspective on everything changes. And I remember my last year of playing a decent level football was like suddenly this is not the be all and end all. So I was more relaxed on game day, more relaxed at training. I was still working just as hard, but I wasn't getting myself so caught in what was going to happen. Of course, what happens, you have some of your best years in those last few years because you've got the balance. But also it's like it's also an element of purpose beyond sport, which is why I'm big on helping athletes find like who are you beyond the sport? Who are you beyond even yourself? Like what's the thing that's bigger, even bigger than you, that you just naturally gravitate towards? It sounds like from the last conversation too, we're talking similar language through a bit of a different lens, but it's the crazy thing is it's just not happening more.
No. And I think, you're dead right. I think we just don't teach enough about that balance and where that line is. But I think, to be fair, I think there's a lot of, speaking to a few athletes now, I think there is starting to be a little bit more around that. Hey, I want a bit more outside of sport. They're definitely, and that's coming from the athletes more so than it's coming from anywhere else. So there's definitely a bit of a change of guard around there, but yeah, still a long, long way to go.
Yeah, absolutely. So how do you go from, maybe you were already doing this. Where do you get into? So you go to finance as a career. Was that something you went straight into? And then how do you, like, do you just try and find your way into the sport sphere as quick as possible? Yeah, or did that happen organically?
Good question. Actually, I wanted to be Jerry Maguire when I first came out of university. That was sort of what I wanted to do. And it's funny, one of the BD partners here, she actually gave me the Jerry Maguire transcript as sort of a present when I became partner here, which was a really nice thing to hand to. Yeah, it was really, really touching. But I sort of, as part of that, got some advice to go, hey, look, if you want to be an agent, go and bust your ass in a professional services firm for 10 years. And then if you still want to do that agency world, then choose then, which was the best advice I've ever got. I still think that's probably the best advice you could give anyone, whatever they want to do. I think building yourself out in professional services for 10 years, whether that's law, you know, accounting, business, whatever, I think it's a really good platform for no matter what you want to do, because you end up getting that commercial mindset sales anyway. And so as part of that, just felt like I sort of was trying to grow a bit of a niche within that towards athletes, and just felt like as part of that process, hey, I think we can do better in the way that we service them. And I didn't want to just service them as an agent for 10 years. I wanted to service them for 60. So I was sort of like, well, how can we extend this beyond just the sporting thing? And I sort of get more excited now about, right, what are you doing after sport? Like, that's awesome. Like, I love that. I love my sport, but I want to know what you want to do next. Like, that to me is like an awesome thing, that how can we get, you know, whatever you do next to be almost, if not more significant than what you did on the field, you may have it off the field as well. So I think that's what I'm really, that's where it's sort of gravitated to. And then, yeah, just through the sport that I played, connections, that's sort of how it's built from there.
I'd be curious to hear the reaction from athletes when you're like, because when they're immersed in it, they're so committed and so into it that maybe they even know all the data is there that the majority of their career is going to be after sport. Like, how do they respond when you're trying to take them, even if it's just from a thinking perspective, to where they're going to be heading when they maybe just want to focus on what's going on now?
Yeah, I think in the back of their mind, they know that that's the right way to start thinking about it. I think sometimes they don't, and again, that's why I go back to that education piece. I think sometimes they don't know how to do that, and that's obviously the role that people like yourself and, you know, we play in trying to guide them on that. I think there is definitely a mindset where they know they need to do that. I just think sometimes because of the high performance nature of what they're in, it gets put back. And I mean, you go to any industry and the people that are at the high echelon of that, they're always grappling with that, right? What do I need to actually focus on that's going to set me up versus, you know, what's a priority versus a you know, a non-negotiable, etc. So I think it's just, and because they're so much younger, it's a challenge, like, you know, you know, I've been in accounting, since 2008, so 17 years sort of thing. Yeah. Like, I've had 17 years of experience of trying to work that out, and I'm still trying to grapple with what should be my priorities versus what should be my things that I need to put on the back burner for a while. So asking a 21-year-old to do it is you know, it's asking a lot of them. So, but I think the mindset's there. I think there is some conversations now that we're having where they're keen to do that. It's just about guiding them on, righto, well, again, I think just coming down to it, what do you want to do after? Have you thought about it? Righto, if you haven't, that's just go and try a few things. Because I think that's another thing. Like, if you get in and find out what you don't want to do early doors, that's a lot of time that we could save on the back end of, you know, going and doing a business degree or going, you know, doing a part-time role somewhere that, you know, well, we could have found that out a lot earlier during your career.
Yeah, good call. Cut a few shortcuts. So I'm curious, what was the inspiration behind wanting to be that Jerry Maguire type figure? Like, was it? Well, yeah, you tell me. What was the
I mean, I've definitely always been passionate about sport, but I think the one thing for me, the sport's had a really positive impact on my life. Like, I think the people I've been able to meet, you know, the places I've been able to travel because of it. Even just giving myself some process and some goals of what I'm trying to achieve, some personal stuff that I've been able to achieve because of it. It's given me a lot of positivity. I've seen how much sport can make a positive impact. Like, even as a Raiders fan, going down to Suncorp and taking my son down there and just seeing how happy it made people just because the Broncos won, and it brings a community together. Like, actually a really good example of that, I think, I can't remember exactly, but I'm pretty sure if you have a look at after the 2011 floods in Brisbane, I'm pretty sure if you have a look at the teams that won that year or the season after, I think the Queensland Reds won, the Brisbane Roar won that year, Queensland won the State of Origin, the Queensland Bulls won the 11-12 Shield season.
Yeah, wow.
I think Netball Queensland, I think the Firebirds might have won as well. There might be one or two that I've got wrong there, but I think it's like a lot of them. Now, I don't reckon that's a coincidence that that's happened after that flood period where it was like community come together. It really, you know, got, you know, the whole community together, and the whole town felt like, righto, let's get behind this now that we can do this. And I reckon it really brought everyone together. So I think that's a really good example of where sport should always have a positive outcome. And so I suppose when I saw negative outcomes coming from sport because of people being within sport and it almost creating a negative outcome for humans, that really gets to me, and that really drives me to make sure that anyone who comes in sport, don't get me wrong, people are going to have bad days on a sporting field, people are going to break stuff, there's still going to be injuries, there's going to be heartbreak, you know, there's going to be a lot of epic football players that never win a premiership and those sort of things, and it all, As an athlete, that'll always grapple you. Like, there's still a second grade grand final in cricket that keeps me awake at night every month. That's just the innate in your nature of being competitive in sport. But I think ultimately, sport should always have a positive impact on a person's life. And as soon as it's being involved in creating a negative impact, we're not doing it right, and it's not being done for the right purpose. So I think that's probably what really drives me around that.
Love it. Was there a negative, like specific negative moment for you or something you witnessed that sort of helped you really see that contrast?
I mean, I definitely had a year where I focused on sport too much, and it definitely had a bad impact on the way, well, on my sport first, because I felt like I had a sort of like a bit of a breakthrough year in rugby in 07, and then I was like, right, I'm going all in. And just everything sort of fell apart in terms of my focus on university and my, you know, a few other things, and sort of ended up finishing uni halfway, like had to push out a year, and just a lot of things like that where I didn't prioritize it. And so definitely sort of a bit of a wake up call, because I ended up not having a great 2008 year and a few other things. So, I can definitely see how it snowballs and that totally gets flown out. But again, it's trying to work out where sport fits within you. And again, I think sport ultimately has to be, the reason you got to play sport is because it's enjoyable. Yeah. I think as soon as we lose, 100%, I'm all about winning. I'm the most competitive person in the world. But I think ultimately you've got to have fun wanting to win as well. So it's still got to be enjoyable on the field. You've got to enjoy the moments within it, even if you lose or don't quite achieve what you want to achieve on the field.
Yeah, spot on. And that's true from top to bottom. Like the guys at the top talk about that. Like when things aren't going well, have we lost the fun? Yeah, it's spot on. You obviously keep yourself fit now. Like, do you still play any sport, or like how, or have you got that? You've just got that athletic health mindset that still keeps you going forward.
Yeah, I don't. Probably the one thing I really miss at the moment is probably team sport. I probably would like to get back and do something, whether that's touch or something like that, or. You know, I'm 40 next year, so we'll qualify for a few over 40s competitions next year. So definitely that's something I miss, and definitely something I'd like to probably start doing again, but just time of life with kids, and I've got 3 kids of 5 and under at the moment, so it's a bit of a
bit going on.
But at the same time, I try and go to the gym or go for a run at lunchtime every day at work. Yeah. I'd sort of put it in my calendar. It's a bit of a non-negotiable, even if it means I have to work late at night, that's fine. As long as I get my exercise in during the day, then and obviously being middle of the day doesn't take away from my family time either, so it allows me to sort of not eat into the family time. And then if I have to do work on the back end to cover that, then I will.
Love it. What I know about that, when you have any child under 5, it's a hectic time. And I have had that conversation with people before, even family members, when they're like, oh, no, I just, you know, I'm not coping. I'm like, you've got a child under 5, like, just give yourself some space. So for the listeners, like a learning piece, how do you keep yourself motivated, but also organized enough to make sure, I know you said you have it in the lunch break, but then that's going to eat into work, and I know there's a lot of probably people listening to this who would just work, they don't even feel like they've got the time, they can't commit. So how do you make sure you've got that discipline and that commitment to make sure you have that time and the motivation to continue to prioritize your health?
Yeah, it's probably a little bit of ownership as well on, like, you know, putting it in. I know that I'm a pretty grumpy person if I don't get my exercise, so I'm not going to be a very good person around, and I'm probably not going to work at a good rate if I don't. So it's probably that awareness of knowing that as well. Like, I don't always get out at every lunchtime. Like, sometimes it doesn't happen. And I also have to be aware for myself that I don't get caught up in that and go, oh, I didn't exercise, so therefore everything's gone to crap. Like, I sort of have to go, that's fine. Didn't happen today, you know, and it was out of your control. I did everything in my control to make sure it would happen. It just didn't, because meetings come in and things happen. But you know, that you sort of have to be accountable in that essence. I also like exercising from a mental point of view. Like, I do it just as much. To me, going for a run is just like getting outside and having a bit of a mental health break sort of thing. So it's sort of covering off on a, it's not just a physical thing. It's a mental thing as well, in terms of giving me some mental exercise as well. So, you know, going and having a run, and, you know, I just did one today where I've had 3 different things coming at me. I've had people issues within work and outside of work and client issues, and I'm like, just if I go for a run, usually that gives me a bit of clarity to go, right, now I know how to approach that thought. So I'm definitely I'm disciplined about it. I'm pretty non-negotiable about trying to exercise, but I've also incorporated in a way that I enjoy it as well. So I enjoy going out for a run. I enjoy going and doing a gym session with, Wednesdays I do a group session with a couple of guys that are about my age, and we're pretty competitive. So, you know, I sort of get that competitive edge out of that space as well.
So good. So just to reiterate for the listeners, it's important, why it's important for you to do your exercise. You get that self-awareness. Some flexibility, I think that's an important one. Sometimes stuff happens and you don't get to it every day, and not being hard on yourself. It's that self-accountability, but you've also got the group sessions, so there's like some external accountability too, which I reckon is good. Knowing the mental effort, you've got to be disciplined, non-negotiable, and I think the most important one you include there is you've got to enjoy it. It's like, it's even just fitting it in and around your day. Like when I was in corporate, it was the same thing. I was like, I'll just go for a run at lunchtime. Like, the workplace is going to get the best out of me if I'm making sure I'm doing that. And I used to say the same thing to my staff. It's like, just you just got to fit it in.
And I think flexible work, I think that's actually where flexible working has been the best. Yeah. It's not necessarily the fact that you get to work from home. It's the fact that you can work from home in and around that. So for me, the best thing about working from home has actually been at that exec level where, you know, you, in back in the day, you would have just stayed in the office till midnight. Whereas now I can, yeah, I can still do a lunchtime fitness session. If the wife needs me at home to help with the kids, I can go home a little bit earlier, and then I'm happy to be online till midnight. And I'm lucky that my work allows me to be able to work from home in that way. But that has allowed me to sort of, I'm still here with my staff majority of the day. I'm also doing some family time between that sort of 4 or 7 hectic period. But then I can also get online and go a bit later once, you know, the whole family's down for bed. So I actually think that flexibility working has been better for the exec level rather than the grads and the young staff coming through.
Yeah, right. And that all the data says that people are getting more done, not less, by having that flexibility.
Yeah, I'd argue it probably depends a little bit on who you're speaking to.
The individual.
And again, it depends on the individual, right? Like that's, I think that's a really, really good point. I think it's about maximizing what you can. Like I think working from home is a great thing to a point, but we still need to get the most out of the days. We still, you know, at the same time, productivity is declining rapidly as well. So there's a sort of like where's the balance, and there's a level of professionalism as well, and it totally depends on what industry you're talking about, I suppose.
Exactly, and people connection, like, which is so important for everything. Like we talked about it with sport, the importance of community and the impact of that. If it's everyone's just working remotely, yes, you're connecting in online meetings, but it's not the same as coming together physically. So, getting the balance right. Again, it's the word that we've kind of used a few times through this chat.
Big on balance.
So you talked about the second grade final that still eats away at you. What about your best story? Let's start firstly as you the sportsman, and then maybe one as a fan.
So probably the biggest, I was really lucky in 2010, I was part of the first grade uni side here in Brisbane. We won the premiership and uni hadn't won for 20 years. So it was sort of, and it had always been sort of, you know, we were always sort of one of the top four teams most years, and we'd had a, you know, the people from that 1990 grand final were like, you know, Wallabies, like the Liners, you know, some epic names that were involved in that. And so the club had gone through a bit of a lean patch, and to be part of that team and break sort of that drought was awesome. And especially as probably someone that didn't play at the high level, and yet in our team we had some, I think there was about 13 Super Rugby players that ended up playing in that game. Wow. In our team. I think there was only me and two other blokes that didn't end up playing Super Rugby after that. So to be part of that team was pretty awesome. And at the same time, I also won a first grade cricket premiership, I think the next year, in a T20. So that was pretty, and while I got my CA in 2012, CA 2012, and I was working full-time that whole time. So that was quite a cool achievement while working full-time, doing study, doing all that. So, and again, we talk about balance. That was sport. I reckon the reason I enjoyed that so much was sport was my outlet through that study period. I was really lucky. But to be honest, I've been really lucky with the teams and the clubs that I was involved in. I through eras of real big success. So I got first grade, I won a 2010, 2012, 2014. So really, really lucky. I won a 2004 Colts premiership and a 2016 reserve grade premiership in my last year of rugby. So like I won 5 premierships in, you know, 10 years of rugby. So I was pretty lucky to do that. Like that's pretty significant. And then cricket, same, like second grade, we won you know, we're in the final or in the finals pretty much every year from about 2009 onwards, sort of thing. And then because of that, our first grade team were really successful as well, and they had a really good area of cricket, and I was in and out of that occasionally as well. So when I got my opportunity to play first grade, was awesome as well. So I think just during that was awesome. That 2010 was probably the standout probably moment more than anything.
Yeah, can we dive a bit deeper into that? Because I imagine, like, if you've played any sport and you've had those winning moments, you know how big they are. But when it's like a club like that that's been known for success and they've been in a drought, a bit like the Eels, a bit like the Raiders, or the, like it's a big moment, right? Like, so what's your enduring memory of that time and just how good it was, not just through the season, but those final matches when you're really building momentum and bringing it home?
Yeah, so, I mean, 07, 08, 09, like I was sort of part of a team that we would tend to get flogged a little bit. Wasn't horrible, but we were always sort of lower to mid-table. And a lot of us stuck around. It wasn't like we went off, stuff this, we're going to another club to go further. It was like, no, we've got a good core group. Socially, we really enjoyed each other's company. We were really good mates off the field. The club was still a good club on and off the field, whether that was, and we might have all had parents that were involved in the club or whatever. So there was a good core culture there. It was just that, you know, we might have been lacking some, you know, the odd player here or there. So I think because we had that core group and I was part of that initial core group, being part of that whole journey through to 2010 was really awesome. So I think that was something that was really important, that we had that core culture. I think organic, and I don't think we tried to create a culture. It was just organically it was already there. So I think that was a really positive thing. And then we sort of came. There was a few changes with presidents and, you know, a few people there. Coach changed, and we sort of had a 5-year plan, and it sort of happened in 1 year. So it was sort of it was quite interesting around that. So yeah, that was a pretty awesome year.
You've been a bit modest still. I want to hear about the moments, like, you know, what was it? Did you have a moment, or maybe not even from that season, like the actual game? Like, you know, people listening want to hear like something that they can relate to of the magic of sport, right?
Yeah, what's the moment? I mean, I was the goal kicker through that whole 2010 year, so there was always some pivotal moments in terms of the goal kicking. So there was always that pressure, and I wanted that, you know. Like, I think that was something that I enjoyed, the pressure of the goal kicking. So that was something that I sort of took a lot of pride in and worked really hard at. Didn't always get it right, but in that final, I think I kicked a penalty in the wet from like 40 to sort of like give us some real confidence that we should get home now. So
yeah.
Even though I felt like we were always going to win, we're always the dominant team, I actually scored the first try of the match too, which that's, there's a funny story to that actually. There was I had a bet with one of the club, one of the board members who was a really good friend of mine, and he basically said, if you kick a perfect round, like kick 7 from 7 or 8 from 8 or whatever, I'll give you $100 or something. And then we kept compounding the bet, and we got to the last game, and I was about $800 in debt by then. And he said, if you score the first try though, I'll wipe the debt. And I was like, okay, deal. And scored the first try. So that's all I could think about when I scored the try. I was like, yes, I don't owe $800 now. So that was quite funny. And the club always ran what was called a Calcutta back in the day as well. So basically to bet on the first try scorer. And I think his brother had me as the first try scorer. It got me really cheap because no one expected me to score a try. So that was quite funny that was all I could think about, and I missed that kick, and I missed the kick from the sideline in that because I didn't care anymore. I was so relieved that I just wiped the bet.
Oh, there you go. So you've been understanding the pain of financial stress in sport for years.
That's right.
Oh, but isn't that a great example of when you can take the pressure off and make it about something else? You can almost relax the rest of your performance. Yeah. I can just imagine you getting up and pointing at the bloke as you score the try as well.
I think that's a fun, and I think that's why that club level is still really humming. Like, there's still that. There's that weird sort of amateurish, but there's professional people involved in the sport at the same time. And I think that's why I sort of enjoyed that level, because it did have that, it still had that club relaxed. You know, I definitely probably couldn't do make bets and stuff like that if I was playing at the top level. So even though they're internally and you're not trying to fix games or anything, it was, you know, like those, the fun stories like that that you hear from like old days and stuff. You hear stories like that all the time. So yeah, that was sort of the enjoyable part of that.
What about as a fan? What's your favourite sporting moment as a fan?
That's a great question. I have really, really good memories of staying up, which, even though we lost in 05 in the Ashes, like Warnie's performance as an individual. And I just, I love that type of, you know, that theatre of Test cricket. So that was really awesome. When Scotty won the Masters, like, I still remember going and having coffee for 2 hours because it just kept dragging on, you know. Like, I would just go and watch him do the fight. I think I finished, we went for coffee at 9 o'clock and finished the coffee at 11 a.m. or something by the time he'd finished. So, and I think the fact that he was so exuberant around showing that he was that Aussie, like when he said, come on Aussie, doing that, like I have such vivid memories of that and sitting with a mate watching that. So I really, even though it's not a team sport, he almost had that team mentality that this is an Australian thing. I'd love, that's a moment that I'll never forget watching that live.
So good. You've triggered some memories for me, because that was one of the great blessings of working on Fox Sports, is when those sorts of events, especially anything in the US that finished on a Monday morning, like you'd imagine, like all massive sport fans sitting around in an office and there's TVs on every desk and we're all watching that, and the sort of the raw ripples, not just through Augusta, but it ripples through the whole building. And it made me think also, was it Atlanta before Sydney?
Was Atlanta, yep.
Yeah, I think it was Cathy Freeman in the 400 final, where she sort of got to first at the bend and the whole sort of office again went up and she didn't win it, but it's just, yeah. I think anyone who's been a fan remembers those moments and they just stick with you, don't they, because of the emotion.
Yeah, I think that was definitely Devin Martin. In turn, like I was really lucky in 2013, and again from the rugby team that I played with in Hong Kong, one of the guys was a member at Muirfield where they played the Open that year, and I was really lucky to go to watch the Open and watch that, walk around, watch the players. You know, it's always good watching that golf, and especially as an Aussie interacting with the fans. Me and my mates sort of dressed up in Australian jackets, and you know, Jason Days and those guys were sort of interacting with us because we were cheering them on. So, and they really appreciate it. But I actually got to play on the course 2 days later, which with the stands still up, and you know, you're in the same position as some of the players that day. So that was just an awesome experience to see, one, how bloody good those guys are, but also just to sort of almost experience what they experience as well, because you don't tend to get that very often. So that was a cool experience.
Oh, so good. Well, I went to the Open in 2017. They were very much a different crowd to what we saw in the Ryder Cup just recently.
that was loose.
Crazy. I didn't get to play, but my boss went over for Masters, and he just happened to get drawn out and got to play there, and he was just talking about like what an experience that was, and just different, those courses when they're set up for tournament. Different level, the speed of the greens, the different angles that the caddy's got to talk them through. I mean, you wouldn't have had the luxury, I'm sure. Or did you like have a look at one of the on-course caddies get you take through, or are you flying blind?
So Muirfield was quite interesting, actually. So you play that Irish two ball. So you, like, someone hits you, hit, someone hits you. And that's how they traditionally play those fields. So you actually get through in about 2.5 hours of 18 holes. One, because the rough is so thick, you actually need someone down there trying to watch your ball go into the rough, because we don't have people running around trying to find the ball for you. So that was sort of a benefit of it. But the whole experience of the day, so you actually got to, the way Muirfield do it was there's a field go out in the morning, and then they have lunch and you have lunch, and then there's the people having lunch, and then they go out a little bit tipsy, to be honest, in the afternoon. So you have to dress up in a suit, there's a tie. So it was more the whole experience of being involved in that. So, didn't have caddies, but we sort of got that. And we were playing with members, so they were very familiar with the course and stuff as well. But, yeah,
Awesome, awesome experience.
Oh, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was going to ask you about your two experiences playing in another country, because everyone I've spoken to just said, like, it was such a great experience to do something different, and just how much they include you, especially cricket in the UK. I went over there in 98. Yeah. I was watching my mate play, and again, just like envious of like that experience for him. And then, yeah, so I'm sure you've got great memories of those times as well, both in the UK and Hong Kong.
Yeah, I mean, UK, I was only about 19, and most of my team was about 40.
Right.
So you're brought over there to basically carry a team and to get them promoted the next year is effectively your job. Yeah. But that was an awesome experience, just to be part of a, you know, fun community. To be honest, you're just socialising. There just happens to be a game of cricket going on. So that was awesome to be part of our community as well. Like, basically the whole town revolved around the pub and the cricket team. So that was really fun. Hong Kong was a seriously different experience. Like, it was more, rugby players with a drinking problem half the time, but also that real weird mix of sort of, you know, it was anywhere from guys who had played in the Premiership in the UK all the way through to like almost like Hong Kong local kids that would be like a third, fourth grade level, and sort of mixing them all into one team. So was really interesting. But getting to understand that culture and mixing in with that, and I was living in the middle of Mong Kok, and so I was, yeah, really cool experience. And then, as I said, just the mates that I've got from that, been to weddings in Greece and the UK and Scotland and here in Australia and all over the shop because of that. So, yeah, amazing, amazing networks that you get from that.
So good. All right, now we've talked mainly about athletes and the work that you do in that space, but what you've described earlier on in the chat around, you know, your financial health, getting that purposeful element to what you're doing and focusing on what you're doing, it's like applies across the board, right? So anyone listening to this, even if they're not an elite athlete, it's the same principle, right? So what's the best learning or the best place for them to start to sort of get their I think you called it you do a health check first. What do you call it, is the process that a good place for people to start?
Yeah, I think for me, I think this is where it's really hard. And again, I think the government probably needs to step in a little bit here, because there's been a lot of red tape put through advice, which has then increased the cost of it. Yeah. So I think, you know, anywhere it starts, you've got to go and get good independent advice, no matter where you are. Unfortunately, sometimes it can be costly, but there are good providers that don't. And there are certain services that are provided where they may have like a brokerage fee or whatever, so it doesn't actually cost you out of pocket, but they're still getting you the right service. So I think just having a bit of a general overview and reviewing things all the time, like, it can't be a stagnant process. So having a look at your tax position, having a look at your tax affairs, do I have the right advisor? Whether that's a financial advisor, am I getting the right financial advice? And again, you usually require the advice the bigger the wealth that you build up, and so therefore the cost should increase because you want better advice. But I think the other thing is just making sure, and this is one of the things we have in our first module, is just having a look at who's on your bus. So I always say, have a look, who's your advisor, who's your lawyer, who's your mentor. I think there wouldn't be anyone who's been successful that would say they didn't have a mentor. All of them have mentors. So I think getting a really good mentor is really, really important. But again, just sort of revisiting who's on your bus, including family. Like, family might be on your bus for a particular role. That might change. It might not be appropriate for them to be on the bus anymore. It might be appropriate to add someone from your family onto your bus. Like, it just depends. So I think revisiting that, it's not a stagnant process. But I just think little things like, you should be asking your accountant's advisors questions and pushing them on, and you can get a pretty good idea pretty quickly if they know what they're talking about. Yeah. And you can sort of read through the bull crap, as you say.
Yeah, it's good. I'm glad you brought up mentors, because I was going to ask you that, whether it's been through sport or business, like, is there a good lesson that you've learnt from a mentor over time that's really stuck with you?
I was really lucky with my, so I've only worked at two places once. I've been in accounting, so, and I've been really lucky to go to two firms that had really good cultures and had some really good mentors within them. So been very blessed from that perspective. But my first role and first firm that I was at for 12 years, a partner there was an amazing mentor in terms of, again, we talk about balance, getting the balance right between, you know, being approachable as a human, but also I always knew he was my boss as well. And I think what he did really well was you always knew that there was a line there between, well, he's definitely my boss, but I feel like I can approach him as an equal as well. And I think getting that balance right has left me in good stead in terms of how I deal with my staff now from a relationship point of view and getting that right. So I think that's been a really good thing that I've learned from him. And then again, here, when I've moved to here, I've had some really good mentors around getting the right. I think, again, even though that person's not my mentor, that advice to go and just bust your ass in a professional services firm for 10 years, like, that's the best advice I've ever been given. And I think we could start applying that a little bit across a few industries. I think sport especially, I'd love to see people actually go and do professional services before jumping into sports administration rather than going into sports administration from the get-go. I think just the learning outcomes that we can get out of that, and they can bring that commercial mindset into sport. I think sport could do with a lot more of that. You know, there's an argument that government being able to provide that sort of opportunity as well, where, hey, maybe being in the private sector for a little bit before we jump in the public sector would be really beneficial, and vice versa, where there's really good people in the public sector that can serve well in the private sector. So I think the way we do that. So that to me is sort of I was really lucky getting that advice around, you know, because otherwise I could have just been straight in the agent world and done that, and, you know, who knows where I'd be, but I'm happy with where it sort of pushed me.
Yeah, awesome. I think we had a bit of a joke about this when we first chatted, and you said, like, sometimes accountants get a bad rap, but I think what you've shown today is what you showed me in the last conversation, is if you need an accountant, you want it to be someone who's actually got some personality and shares common interests. And, mate, I enjoyed that chat, and I really enjoyed this one. So where can people find out more about you, whether you're an athlete, but you also do personal finance stuff as well? Where can people find you, Will?
Yeah, so I'm on LinkedIn. If you go to the BDO website, where I work here in Brisbane, you can find me there as well. So I'm not great on sort of Instagram and those sort of things. I sort of miss that boat a little bit. I probably should be a bit better, but on LinkedIn, I'm quite active on LinkedIn too. I think back in 2023, I did sort of like an athlete tip every month on the 15th, because that was the number I played for when I was playing footy. So did that back in 23, and sort of had like a whole range of athlete tips. So always trying to sort of guide the in athlete world, but obviously for the accounting stuff we do, we sort of advise sort of like all biz service tax partners. We sort of have a pretty broad scope of clients that we look after.
Yeah, it's good. We'll make sure you get your links in the show notes there so people can check you out as well, especially if they're an athlete and they're looking for that guidance around their financial health and that. Not transition. Would you say repurpose your
repurposing? Career? I stole that. Yeah. I stole that from Dan Carter, to be fair. So I can't take all the credit from that.
He's a good guy to steal from. He's certainly had success in a lot of areas. So I think we all take a bit of the best stuff from the people we listen to along the journey. So
absolutely,
yeah, good stuff, mate. That was a cracker. Thanks for coming on, Will. Appreciate it, mate.
No, thanks for having me. Really enjoyed the chat. Thank you.
Cheers. Today's conversation with Will has given us some practical insights into finding balance between sport, work, family, and life, and how prioritizing your health, your finances, and your fun can set you up for long-term success both on and off the field. Take the lessons from Will's stories, the strategies for maximizing your earning capacity, and the reminder to make sport fun, and start applying them to your own life game plan. If you want a simple, practical way to build balance, focus, and consistency in less than 15 minutes a day, check out my performance meditation training. I'll put the link in the notes. You've taken the time to listen to this whole episode. Now it's time to take action. Commit to one thing you've learned today and make it happen. And to avoid any obstructions, join the Sport is Life movement by clicking on the link in the show notes.